She stood like that for a long time.
Pale,
a small tremble in her lower lip. Then she spoke. Just a whisper, she said.
I asked him to. I begged him. I said we could start again, anywhere he wanted, anywhere in the world. I said we could change our names, anything. But he wouldn't agree. Stupid, stupid man.
Then she cried, right there on the street, outside her place of work. Her knees buckled, and she staggered a step, and Reacher caught her and held her tight. Her tears soaked his shirt. Her body trembled. She wrapped her arms around him. She crushed her face into his chest. She wailed and cried for her shattered life, her broken dreams. The telephone call 2 years before, the chaplain's visit to her door, the X-rays, the filthy hospitals, the unstoppable hiss of the respirator. Afterward, they walked up and down the block together, aimlessly, just to be moving. The sky was gray with low cloud, and the air smelled like rain was on the way. Vaughn wiped her face on Reacher's shirt tail and ran her fingers through her hair. She blinked her eyes clear and swallowed and took deep breaths. They ended up outside the police station again, and Reacher saw her gaze trace the line of 20 aluminum letters fixed to the brick. Hope Police Department. She said,
"Why didn't Rafael Ramirez make it?"
Reacher said, "Because Ramirez was different." Chapter 66. Reacher said, "One phone call from your desk will explain it. We might as well go ahead and make it, since we're right here anyway. Maria has waited long enough." Vaughn said, "One call to who?" "The MPs west of Despair. You were briefed about them, they'll have been briefed about you. Therefore, they'll cooperate."
"What do I ask them?"
"Ask them to fax Ramirez's summary file. They'll say, who? You'll tell them, bullshit. You know Maria was just there, so you know who he is. And tell them we know Maria was there for 21 hours, which is enough time for them to have gotten all the paperwork in the world."
"What are we going to find?"
"My guess is Ramirez was in prison 2 weeks ago." The Hope Police Department's fax machine was a boxy old product, standing alone on a rolling cart. It had been square and graceless to start with, and now it was grubby and worn. But it worked. 11 minutes after Vaughn finished her call, it sparked up and started whirring, and sucked a blank page out of the feeder tray and fed it back out with writing on it. Not much writing. It was a bare-bones summary. Very little result for 21 hours of bureaucratic pestering. But that was explained by the fact that it had been the Army doing the asking and the Marines doing the answering. Inter-service cooperation wasn't usually very cooperative. Rafael Ramirez had been a private in the Marine Corps. At the age of 18, he had been deployed to Iraq. At the age of 19, he had served a second deployment. At the age of 20, he had gone AWOL ahead of a third deployment. He had gone on the run, but had been arrested 5 days later in Los Angeles and locked up awaiting court-martial back at Pendleton. Date of arrest, 3 weeks previously. Reacher said, "Let's go find Maria." They found her in her motel room. Her bed had a dent where she had been sitting, staying warm, saving energy, passing time, enduring. She answered the door tentatively, as if she was certain that all news would be bad. There was nothing in Reacher's face to change her mind. He and Vaughn led her outside and sat her in the plastic lawn chair under her bathroom window. Reacher took Room 9's chair, and Vaughn took Room 7's. They dragged them over and positioned them and made a tight little triangle on the concrete apron. Reacher said, "Raphael was a Marine." Maria nodded, said nothing. Reacher said, "He had been to Iraq twice. He didn't want to go back a third time. So nearly 4 weeks ago, he went on the run. He headed up to L.A. Maybe he had friends there. Did he call you?" Maria said nothing. Vaughn said, "You're not in trouble, Maria. Nobody's going to get you for anything." Maria said, "He called most days." Reacher asked, "How was he?"
"Scared. Scared to death. Scared of being AWOL. Scared of going back."
"What happened in Iraq?"
"To him? Not much, really. But he saw things. He said the people we were supposed to be helping were killing us, and we were killing the people we were supposed to be helping. Everybody was killing everybody else, in bad ways. It was driving him crazy."
"So he ran, and he called most days."
Maria nodded.
"But then he didn't call for 2 or 3 days, is that right?"
"He lost his cell phone. He was moving a lot to stay safe. Then he got a new phone."
"How did he sound on the new phone?"
"Still scared. Very worried, even worse."
"Then what?"
"He called to say he had found some people, or some people had found him. They were going to get him to Canada, through a place called Despair in Colorado. He said I should come here to Hope and wait for his call, then I should join him in Canada."
"Did he call from Despair?"
"No."
"Why did you go to the MPs?
"To ask if they had found him and arrested him. I was worried. But they said they had never heard of him. They were Army, he was Marine Corps."
"And so you came back here to wait some more?" Maria nodded. "It wasn't exactly like that. He was arrested in L.A. The Marines caught up with him. He didn't lose his phone. He was in jail for 2 or 3 days."
"He didn't tell me that."
"He wasn't allowed to."
"Did he break out again?"
Reacher shook his head. "My guess is he made a deal. The Marine Corps offered him a choice. 5 years in Leavenworth, or go undercover to bust the escape line that ran from California all the way to Canada. Names, addresses, descriptions, techniques, routes, all that kind of stuff. He agreed, and they drove him back to L.A. and turned him loose. That's why the MPs didn't respond. They found out what was going on and were told to stonewall you."
"So where is Raphael now? Why doesn't he call?"
Reacher said, "My father was a Marine. Marines have a code. Did Raphael tell you about it?"
"Unit, Corps, God, Country."
Reacher nodded. "It's a list of their loyalties, in priority order. Raphael's primary loyalty was to his unit, his company, in fact. Really, just a handful of guys like him."
"I don't understand."
"I think he agreed to the deal but couldn't carry it through. He couldn't betray guys just like him. I think he rode up to Despair but didn't call in to the Marines. I think he hung around on the edge of town and stayed out of sight because he was conflicted. He didn't want to know who was involved because he was afraid he might have to give them away later. He hung out for days agonizing. He got thirsty and hungry. He started hallucinating and decided to walk over to Hope and find you and get out some other way."
"So where is he?"
"He didn't make it, Maria. He collapsed halfway. He died."
"But where is his body?"
"The people in Despair took care of it."
"I see."
Then for the second time in an hour, Reacher watched a woman cry. Vaughn held her, and Reacher said, "He was a good man, Maria. He was just a kid who couldn't take any more. And in the end, he didn't betray what he believed in." He said those things over and over again, in different orders and with different emphases, but they didn't help. Maria was all cried out after 20 minutes, and Vaughn led her back inside. Then she joined Reacher again, and they walked away together. She asked,
"How did you know?"
Reacher said, "No other rational explanation."
"Did he really do what you said? Agonized and then sacrificed himself?"
"Marines are good at self-sacrifice. On the other hand, maybe he double-crossed the Corps from the get-go. Maybe he planned all along to head straight to Hope and grab Maria and disappear."
"It doesn't take 4 days to walk from despair to hope."
"No, it doesn't."
"So he probably did the right thing."
"I hope that was Maria's impression."
"Do you think he told them about the people in California?"
"I don't know."
"This will carry on if he didn't."
"You say that like it's a bad thing."
"It could get out of hand."
"You could make a couple of calls. They're in the hotel register in despair, name and address. You could check and see who they are and whether they're still around or whether they've disappeared into federal custody."
"I'm sorry about what I said before."
"Don't worry about it." They walked on, and then Reacher said, "And you weren't wrong when you did what you did the night before last. Otherwise, whoever killed David killed you, too."
"You want to give them that?"
"Because I don't. I want you to have a life."
"That sounds like the beginnings of a farewell speech."
"Does it?"
"Why stay? The Pentagon is washing its dirty linen in private, which isn't a crime, and we seem to have decided this other thing isn't a crime either."
"There's one more thing on my mind." Chapter 67. Reacher and Vaughn walked back to the diner, where Reacher ate for the first time since the burger he had scored in the Fort Shaw mess the night before. He topped up his caffeine level with 4 mugs of coffee, and when he had finished, he said, "We need to go see those MPs. Now you've established contact, we might get away with a face-to-face meeting." Vaughn said,
"We're going to drive through despair again?"
Reacher shook his head. "Let's take your truck and go cross-country." They peeled the paper barcodes off the new glass, and Vaughn fetched paper towels and Windex from her kitchen, and they wiped the wax and the handprints off the screen. Then they set off early in the afternoon. Vaughn took the wheel. They drove 5 miles west on Hope's Road and risked another 9 on Despair's. The air was clear, and the mountains were visible ahead, first invitingly close and then impossibly distant. 3 miles before Despair's first vacant lot, they slowed and bumped down off the road onto the scrub and started a long loop to the north. They kept the town on their left, on a 3-mile radius. It was just a blur in the distance. Not possible to tell if it was guarded by mobs or sentries or abandoned altogether. It was slow going across the open land. Undergrowth scraped along the underside, and low bushes slapped at their flanks. The ladder and the wrecking bar in the load bed bounced and rattled. The flashlight rolled from side to side. Occasionally they found dry washes and followed them through looping meanders at a higher speed. Then it was back to picking their way around table rocks bigger than the Chevy itself, and keeping the sun centered on the top rail of the windshield. 4 times they drove into natural corrals and had to back up and start over. After an hour, the town fell away behind them, and the plant showed up ahead on the left. The wall glowed white in the sun. The parking lot looked empty. No cars. There was no smoke rising from the plant. No sparks, no noise, no activity at all. Reacher said, "What day is it?" Vaughn said,
"It's a regular work day."
"Not a holiday?"
"No." "So where is everybody?"
They steered left and narrowed the gap between themselves and the plant. The Chevy was raising a healthy dust plume in the air behind it. It would be visible to a casual observer, but there were no casual observers. They slowed and stopped 2 miles out and waited. 5 minutes, 10, then 15. No circulating Tahoes came around. Vaughn asked,
"What exactly is on your mind?"
"I like to be able to explain things to myself."
"What can't you explain?"
"The way they were so desperate to keep people out. The way they shut down the secret compound for the day just because I was barging around within half a mile of it. The way they found Ramirez's body and dealt with it so fast and efficiently. It was no surprise to them. It's like they set themselves up to be constantly vigilant for intruders. To expect them, even. And they worked out procedures in advance for dealing with them. And everyone in town is involved. The first day I showed up, even the waitress in the restaurant knew exactly what to do. Why would they go to those lengths?"
"They're playing ball with the Pentagon, keeping private things private."
"Maybe. But I'm not sure. Certainly the Pentagon wouldn't ask for that. Despair is already in the middle of nowhere, and the plant is 3 miles out of town, and the bad stuff happens in a walled-off compound inside it. That's good enough for the Pentagon. They wouldn't ask local people to go to bat for them, because they trust walls and distance and geography, not people."
"Maybe Thurman asked the people himself."
"I'm sure he did. I'm certain of it. But why? On behalf of the Pentagon or for some other reason of his own?"
"Like what?"
"Only one logical possibility." "Actually, an illogical possibility. Or a logical impossibility. One word from the MPs and we'll know. If they talk to us at all."
"What word?"
"Either yes or no." There were four guys in the guard shack, which seemed to be their usual daytime deployment. Overkill, in Reacher's opinion, which meant the post was most likely commanded by a lieutenant, not a sergeant. A sergeant would have had two in the shack, and the other two either resting up with the others or out on mobile patrol in a Humvee, depending on the perceived threat assessment. But officers had to sign off on fuel requisitions, which would nix the mobile Humvee, and officers didn't like men sitting around with nothing to do, which is why the shack was overcrowded. But Reacher didn't expect the grunts to be unhappy about it, or about anything. They had been in Iraq, and now they weren't. The only question in his mind was whether their officer had been in Iraq with them. If he had, he might be reasonable. If he hadn't, he might be a royal pain in the ass. Vaughn drove past the base and U-turned, and came back and parked facing the right way, tight on the shoulder, close to but not blocking the gate, like she would outside a fire station, respectful, unwilling to put a foot wrong in the dance that had to be coming. Two guys came out of the guard shack immediately. They were the same two Reacher had seen before. Morgan, the bespectacled specialist with the squint lines, and his partner, the silent private first class. Reacher kept his hands clearly visible and slid out of the truck. Vaughn did the same thing on her side. She introduced herself by name and as an officer with the Hope PD. Morgan saluted her. In a way Reacher knew meant the MPs had run her plate the first time around, despite his best efforts, and that they had found out what her husband had been and what he was now. "Which will help," he thought. Then Morgan turned and looked straight at him.
"Sir?"
"I was an MP myself," Reacher said. "I did your lieutenant's job about 1 million years ago."
"Sir, which unit?"
"The 110th.
"Rock Creek, Virginia,"
Morgan said. A statement, not a question. Reacher said, "I went there a couple of times to get my ass kicked. The rest of the time I was on the road."
"On the road where?"
"Everywhere you've ever been and about 100 other places."
"Sir, that's interesting, but I'm going to have to ask you to move your vehicle.
At ease, Corporal. We'll move it as soon as we've talked to your lieutenant.
On what subject, sir?
That's between him and us. Sir, I can't justify disturbing him on that basis. Move along, soldier. I've read the manual, too. Let's skip a few pages to where you've already determined that this is important.
Is this about the missing Marine private?
Much more interesting.
Sir, it would help me to have fuller particulars.
It would help you to have $1 million and a date with Miss America, too, but what are the chances, soldier? 5 minutes later, Reacher and Vaughn were inside the wire, inside one of the six green metal buildings, face-to-face across a desk with a one-striper called Connor. He was a small, lean man. He was maybe 26 years old. He had been to Iraq, that was for sure. His BDUs were beat up and sandblasted, and his cheekbones were burned shiny. He looked competent, and probably was. He was still alive, and he wasn't in disgrace. In fact, he was probably headed for a captain's rank, pending paperwork. Medals, too, maybe. He asked,
"Is this an official visit from the Hope PD?"
Vaughn said,
"Yes." "You're both members of the department?"
Vaughn said,
"Mr. Reacher is a civilian advisor."
"So how can I help?" Reacher said, "Long story short, we know about the DU salvage at Thurman's plant." Connor said,
"That bothers me a little."
Reacher said, "It bothers us a little, too. Homeland Security rules require us to maintain a register of chemically sensitive sites within 20 miles. He said it as if it was true, which it might have been. Anything was possible with Homeland Security. We should have been told.
You're more than 20 miles from the plant.
20 exactly to downtown, Reacher said. Only 15 to the town limit.
It's classified. You can't put it in a register.
Reacher nodded. We understand that, but we should have been made aware of it privately.
Sounds like you are aware of it.
But now we want to verify some details. Once bitten, twice shy.
Then you need to speak to the Department of Defense.
Better if we don't. They'll wonder how we got wind of it. Your guys talking will be their first guess.
My guys don't talk.
I believe you. But do you want to take a chance on the Pentagon believing you? Connor said,
"What details?"
"We think we're entitled to know when and how the scrap DU gets transported out and what route is used."
"Worried about it rolling down First Street?"
"You bet."
"Well, it doesn't."
"It all goes west?"
"It goes nowhere."
Vaughn said,
"What do you mean?" "You guys aren't the only ones with your panties in a wad. Colorado's pretty uptight. They want to close the interstate and use an armed convoy, which they can't contemplate on a regular basis. Once every 5 years is what they're thinking."
"How long ago did the first convoy leave?"
"It didn't.
The first convoy will happen about 2 years from now." Reacher said, "So right now they're stockpiling the stuff at the plant?"
Connor nodded. "The steel moves out, the DU stays."
"How much have they got there?"
"As of right now, maybe 20 tons.
"Have you seen it?"
Connor shook his head. "Thurman reports monthly by mail."
"You like that?"
"What's not to like?"
"The guy is sitting on a mountain of dangerous stuff."
"And? What could he possibly do with it?"
Chapter 68. Reacher and Vaughn got back in the truck, and Vaughn said,
"Was that answer a yes or a no?"
"Both," Reacher said. "No, it doesn't get moved out. Yes, it's all still there."
"Is that a good both or a bad both?"
Reacher ducked his head and looked up through the screen. The sun was a dull glow behind the cloud, but it was still way above the horizon. 4 hours until dark. We've got time for a considered decision.
It's going to rain.
Probably. Which will wash more TCE into the aquifer? Probably. We're not going to sit here until dark in the rain. No, we're not. We're going to the Holiday Inn and halfway again.
Only if we get separate rooms.
Shut up, Vaughn. We're going to get the same room we got before, and we're going to do all the same things. The same room was not available, but they got one just like it. Same size, same decor, same colors. Indistinguishable. They did all the same things in it. Showered, went to bed, made love. Vaughn was a little reserved at first, but got into it later. Afterwards, she said that David had been better in bed. Reacher wasn't offended. She needed to believe it. And it was probably true. They lay in the rucked sheets, and Vaughn explored Reacher's scars. She had small hands. The bullet hole in his chest was too big for the tip of her little finger. Her ring finger fitted it better. Every woman he had been naked with was fascinated by it, except the woman he had gotten it for. She had preferred to forget. The rain started after an hour. It was heavy. It drummed on the hotel's roof and sheeted against the window. A cozy feeling, in Reacher's opinion. He liked being inside, in bed, listening to rain. After an hour, Vaughn got up and went to shower. Reacher stayed in bed and leafed through the Bible that the Gideons had left in the nightstand. Vaughn came back and asked,
"Why does it matter?"
"Why does what matter?"
"That Thurman is stockpiling depleted uranium."
Reacher said, "I don't like the combination. He's got 20 tons of radioactive waste and 20 tons of TNT. He's an end times enthusiast. I spoke to a minister last night. He said that end times people can't wait to get things started. Thurman himself said there might be precipitating events on the way. He said it kind of smugly, like he secretly knew it was true. And the whole town seems to be waiting for something to happen."
"Thurman can't start the Armageddon. It'll happen when it happens. These people are fanatics. They seem to think they can nudge things along. They're trying to breed red cows in Israel."
"How would that help?"
"Don't ask me. Cows aren't dangerous."
"Another requirement seems to be a major war in the Middle East."
"We've already got one."
"Not major enough."
"How could it be worse?"
"Lots of ways."
"Personally, I don't see any."
"Suppose another country joined in."
"They'd be crazy to."
"Suppose someone fired the first shot for them."
"How would they?"
"Suppose a dirty bomb went off in Manhattan, or D.C., or Chicago. What would we do?"
"According to you, we'd evacuate the city."
"And then?"
"We'd investigate."
Reacher nodded. "We'd have people in hazmat suits crawling all over the wreckage. What would they find?"
"Evidence."
"For sure. They'd identify the materials involved. Suppose they found TNT and depleted uranium."
"They'd make a list of possible sources."
"Correct. Everyone in the world can buy TNT, but DU is rarer. It's a byproduct of an enrichment process that occurs in maybe 20 places.
"Nuclear powers."
"Exactly."
"A list of 20 suspects wouldn't help."
"Exactly," Reacher said again. "And the intended victim isn't going to stand up and take responsibility, because the intended victim didn't know anything about anything in the first place. But suppose we were nudged in the preferred direction."
"How?"
"Remember Oklahoma City? The federal building? That was a big explosion, but they knew it was a Ryder truck. Within hours, they're great at putting tiny fragments together. But presumably one uranium fragment is like another. But suppose you were a state-sponsored terrorist from overseas. You'd want maximum bang for the buck. So if you didn't have quite enough uranium when you were building your bomb, you might use other stuff to pack it out. What other stuff? Maybe pieces of wrecked cars. Vaughn said nothing. Reacher said, suppose the guys in the hazmat suits found fragments of Peugeots and Toyotas sold only in certain markets. Suppose they found fragments of Iranian license plates. Vaughn was quiet for a moment, working it out.
Iran is working with uranium. They're boasting about it.
There you go. What would happen next?
We'd make certain assumptions.
And?
We'd attack Iran.
And after that?
Iran would attack Israel. Israel would retaliate. Everyone would be fighting.
Precipitating events.
That's insane.
These are people that believe red cows signal the end of the world.
These are people who care enough to make sure ash gets a proper burial.
Exactly. Because by anyone's standards, that's a meaningless gesture. Maybe it's just camouflage to make sure no one looks at them too closely.
We have no evidence.
We have an end times nutcase with technical expertise and 20 tons of TNT and 20 tons of DU and 4 Iranian cars and a limitless supply of shipping containers, some of which were last seen in the Middle East.
You think it's possible?
Anything is possible.
But no judge in America would sign off on a search warrant. Not with what we've got. It's not even circumstantial. It's just a crazy theory.
I'm not looking for a search warrant. I'm waiting for dark. Darkness came 2 hours later. With it came doubts from Vaughn. She said,
if you're really serious about this, you should call the state police or the FBI.
I would have to give my name. I don't like to do that.
Then talk to that MP lieutenant. He already knows your name, and it's his bag after all.
He's looking at medals and a promotion. He won't want to rock the boat. It was still raining, a steady, hard downpour. Vaughn said,
you're not a one-man justice department.
What's on your mind?
Apart from legalities?
Yes, apart from those.
I don't want you to go there, because of the radiation.
It won't hurt me.
Okay, I don't want to go there. You said there were fertility issues and birth defects.
You're not pregnant.
I hope.
Me too.
But these things can linger. I might want children one day.
That's progress, Reacher thought. He said, it's the dust that's the problem, and this rain will damp it down. And you don't have to come in, just drive me there. They left 30 minutes later. Halfway was a small place, but it took a long time to get out of it. People were driving cautiously, like they usually did in storms in places that were normally dry. The roads were running with water, like rivers. Vaughn put her wipers on high. They batted back and forth furiously. She found the turn east and took it. Within a minute, the old Chevy was the only car on the road, the only car for miles around. Rain battered the windshield and drummed on the roof.
This is good, Reacher said.
You think?
Everyone will be indoors. We'll have the place to ourselves. They passed the MP post 30 minutes later. There were still 4 guys in the guard shack. They were dressed in rain capes. Their orange nightlight was on. It made 1,000 dull jewels from the raindrops on the windows. Vaughn asked,
will Thurman fly in this weather?
He doesn't need to. They weren't working today. They drove on. Up ahead, they saw a horizontal sliver of blue light. The plant lit up, much smaller than before, like it had moved 10 miles south toward the horizon. But as they got closer, they saw that it hadn't moved. The glow was smaller because only the farthest quarter was illuminated, the secret compound. Vaughn said,
"Well, they're working now."
"Good. Maybe they left the gates open." They hadn't. The personnel gate and the main vehicle gate were both closed. The bulk of the plant was dark. Nearly a mile beyond it, the secret compound was bright and distant and tempting. Vaughn said,
"Are you sure about this?"
"Absolutely."
"Okay. Where?"
"Same place as before." The Tahoe's beaten ruts were soft and full of water. The little Chevy spun its wheels and fishtailed and clawed its way forward. Vaughn found the right place. Reacher said, "Back it in." The wheels spun, and the truck bumped up out of the ruts, and Vaughn stopped it with its tailgate well under the curve of the metal cylinder, which put its rear window about where the base of the Crown Vic's windshield had been.
"Good luck," she said. "And be careful."
"Don't worry," Reacher said. "My biggest risk will be pneumonia." He got out into the rain and was soaked to the skin even before he got his stuff out of the load bed. He knelt in the mud beside the truck and adjusted the ladder to the relaxed L shape that had worked before. He put the flashlight in one pocket and hooked the crook of the wrecking bar in the other. Then he lifted the ladder vertically into the back of the pickup and jammed its feet into the right angle between the load bed floor and the back wall of the cab. He let it fall forward, and the short leg of the L came down flat on top of the cylinder, aluminum against steel, a strange harmonic clonk that sounded twice, once immediately, and then once again, whole seconds later, as if the impact had raced all around the miles of hollow wall and come back stronger. Reacher climbed into the load bed. Rain lashed the metal and bounced up to his knees. It drummed on the steel cylinder above his head and sheeted down off the bulge of its maximum curvature like a thin waterfall. Reacher stepped sideways and up and started climbing. Rain hammered his back. Gravity pulled the wrecking bar vertical, and it hit every tread on the ladder. Steel against aluminum against steel. The harmonics came back, a weird metallic keening modulated by the thrash of the rain. He made it over the angle of the L and stopped. The cylinder was covered in shiny paint, and the paint was slick with running water. Maneuvering had been hard before. Now it was going to be very difficult. He fumbled the flashlight out of his pocket and switched it on. He held it between his teeth and watched the water and picked the spot where half of it was sluicing one way and half the other. The geometric dead center of the cylinder, the continental divide. He lined up with it and eased off the ladder and sat down. An uneasy feeling. Wet cotton on wet paint. Insecure. No friction. Water was dripping off him and threatening to float him away like an aquaplaning tire. He sat still for a long moment. He needed to twist from the waist and lift the ladder and reverse it. But he couldn't move. The slightest turn would unstick him. Newton's law of motion. Every action has an equal and opposite reaction. If he twisted his upper body to the left, the torque would spin his lower body to the right, and he would slide right off the cylinder. An effective design, derived from prison research. 14 feet to the ground. He could survive a controlled fall if he didn't land on a tangle of jagged scrap. But without the ladder on the inside, it wasn't clear how he would ever get out again. Perhaps the gates had simpler switches on the inside, no combination locks. Perhaps he could improvise a ladder out of scrap metal. Perhaps he could learn to weld and
build one. Or perhaps not. He thought, I'll worry about all that later. He sat for a moment more in the rain and then nudged himself forward and rolled over onto his stomach as he slid, and his palms squealed against the wet metal, and the wrecking bar thumped and banged, and then 90 degrees past top dead center he was free-falling through empty air, one split second and two and three. He hit the ground a whole lot later than he thought he would, but there was no scrap metal under him, and his knees were bent, and he went down in a heap and rolled one way, and the wrecking bar went the other. The flashlight spun away. The breath was knocked out of him. But that was all. He sat up, and a fast mental inventory revealed no physical damage beyond mud and grease and oil all over his clothes from the sticky earth. He got to his feet and wiped his hands on his pants, found the flashlight. It was a yard away, still burning bright. He carried it in one hand and the wrecking bar in the other, and stood for a moment behind the pyramid of old oil drums. Then he stepped out and set off walking, south and west. Dark shapes loomed up at him, cranes, gantries, crushers, crucibles, piles of metal. Beyond them, the distant inner compound was still lit up. The lights made a T-shape, a very shallow T. The crossbar was a blazing blue line half a mile long. Above it, light spill haloed in the wet air. Below it, the T-shape's vertical stroke was very short, maybe 14 feet tall. That was all. Maybe 30 feet wide. A very squat foundation for such a long horizontal line. But it was there. The inner gate was open. An invitation. A trap, almost certainly. Like moths to a flame. Reacher looked at it for a long moment, and then slogged onward. The flashlight beam showed rainbow puddles everywhere, oil and grease floating. Rain was washing down through the sand, and capillary action was pulling waste back to the surface. Walking was difficult. Within 10 paces, Reacher's shoes were carrying pounds of sticky mud. He was getting taller with every step. Every time the flashlight showed him a pile of old I-beams or a tangle of old rebar, he stopped and scraped his soles. He was wetter than if he had fallen into a swimming pool. His hair was plastered to his head, and water was running into his eyes. Ahead, he could see the white security Tahoes, blurred and ghostly in the darkness. They were parked side by side to the left of the main vehicle gate, 300 yards away. He headed straight for them. The trip took him 7 minutes, half speed because of the soft ground. When he got there, he turned right and checked the vehicle gate. No luck. On the inside, it had the same gray box as on the outside, the same keypad, the same 3 million-plus combinations. He turned away from it and tracked along the wall and walked past the security office and Thurman's office and the operations office. He stopped outside purchasing, scraped his shoes and climbed the steps and used his fingernails to pull the screws out of the padlock hasp. The door sagged open. He went inside. He headed straight for the row of file cabinets, aimed toward the right-hand end, opened the T-drawer, pulled the Thomas file, the telecoms company, the cell phone supplier. Clipped to the back of the original purchase order was a thick wad of paper. The contracts, the details, the anytime minutes, the taxes, the fees, the rebates, the makes, the models, and the numbers. He tore off the sheet with the numbers and folded it into his pants pocket. Then he headed back out to the rain. Close to 1 mile, and 40 minutes later, he was approaching the inner gate. Chapter 69. The inner gate was still open. The inner compound was still blazing with light. Up close, the light was painfully bright. It spilled out in a solid bar the width of the opening
and spread and widened like a lighthouse beam that reached 100 yards. Reacher hugged the wall and approached from the right. He stopped in the last foot of shadow and listened, hard. Heard nothing over the pelting rain. He waited one slow minute and then stepped into the light. His shadow moved behind him 50 feet long. No reaction. He walked in, fast and casual. No alternative. He was as lit up and vulnerable as a stripper on a stage. The ground under his feet was rutted with deep grooves. He was up to his ankles in water. Ahead on the left was the first artful pile of shipping containers. They were stacked in an open V, point outward. To their right, and 30 feet farther away, was a second V. He aimed for the gap between them, stepped through, and found himself alone in an arena within an arena within an arena. Altogether, there were 8 stacks of shipping containers arranged in a giant circle. They hid an area of maybe 30 acres. The 30 acres held cranes and gantries and crushers and parked backhoes and bulldozers and carts and dollies and trailers loaded with smaller pieces of equipment. Coils of baling wire, cutting torches, gas bottles, air hammers, high-pressure spray hoses, hand tools, all grimy and battered and well-used. Here and there, leather welder's aprons and dark goggles were dumped in piles. Apart from the industrial infrastructure, there were 2 items of interest. The first, on the right, was a mountain of wrecked main battle tanks. The mountain was maybe 30 feet high and 50 across at the base. It looked like an elephant's graveyard from a grotesque, prehistoric nightmare. Bent gun barrels reared up like giant tusks or ribs. Turret assemblies were dumped and stacked haphazardly, characteristically low and wide and flat, peeled open like cans. Humped engine covers were stacked on their ends, like plates in a rack, some of them torn and shattered. Side skirts were everywhere, some of them ripped like foil. Parts of stripped hulls were tangled in the wreckage. Some of them had been taken apart by Thurman's men. Most of them had been taken apart much farther away, by different people, using different methods. That was clear. There were traces of desert camouflage paint in some places, but not many. Most of the metal was scorched, dull black. It looked cold in the blue light, and it glistened in the rain, but Reacher felt he could see smoke still rising off it, and hear men still screaming under it. He turned away, looked left. The second item of interest was 100 yards east. It was an 18-wheel semi-truck. A big rig, ready to roll. A tractor, a trailer, a blue 40-foot China Lines container on the trailer. The tractor was a huge, square Peterbilt, old but well-maintained. The trailer was a skeletal flatbed. The container looked like every container Reacher had ever seen. He walked toward it, 100 yards, 2 minutes through mud and water. He circled the rig. The Peterbilt tractor was impressive, a fine paint job, an air filter the size of an oil drum, bunk beds behind the front seats, twin chrome smokestacks, a forest of antennas, a dozen mirrors the size of dinner plates. The container looked mundane and shabby in comparison. Dull paint, faded lettering, a few dings and dents. It was clamped tight to the trailer. It had a double door, secured with the same 4-foot-long levers and the same 4 long bolts that he had seen before. The levers were all in the closed position. There were no padlocks, no plastic telltale tags. Reacher put the wrecking bar in one hand and pulled himself up with the other and got a precarious, slippery foothold on the container's bottom ledge. Got his free hand on the nearest lever and pushed it up. It wouldn't move. It was welded to its bracket. An inch-long worm of metal had been melted into the gap. The three other levers were the same, and the doors had been welded to each other and to their frames. A neat, patient sequence of spot welds had been applied, 6 inches apart, their bright newness hidden by flicks of dirty blue paint. Reacher juggled the wrecking bar and jammed the flat of the tongue into the space between two welds and pushed hard. No result. Impossible. Like trying to lift a car with a nail file. He climbed down and looked again at the trailer clamps. They were turned tight and welded. He dropped the wrecking bar and walked away. He covered the whole of the hidden area and the whole of the no-man's land that lay beyond the stacks of piled containers and the whole length of the perimeter track inside the wall. A long walk. It took him more than an hour. He came back to the inner circle the other way, from the side opposite the inner gates. They were 200 yards away. And they were closing. Chapter 70. The gates were motorized, driven by electricity. That was Reacher's first absurd conclusion. They were moving slowly but smoothly, a consistent speed. Too smooth and too consistent for manual operation. Relentless at about a foot a second. They were already at a right angle to the wall. Each gate was 15 feet wide. 5 yards. The total remaining arc of travel for each of them was therefore about 8 yards. 24 seconds. They were 200 yards away. No problem for a college sprinter on a track. Debatable for a college sprinter in 6 inches of mud. Completely impossible for Reacher. But still he started forward involuntarily, and then slowed as the arithmetic reality hit him. He stopped altogether when he saw four figures walk in through the closing gap. He recognized them immediately by their size and shape and posture and movement. On the right was Thurman. On the left was the giant with the wrench. In the middle was the plant foreman. He was pushing Vaughn in front of him. The three men were walking easily. They were dressed in yellow slickers and sou'wester hats and rubber boots. Vaughn had no protection against the weather. She was soaked to the skin. Her hair was plastered against her head. She was stumbling, as if every few paces she was getting a shove in the back. They all kept on coming. Reacher started walking again. The gates closed with a metallic clang that sounded twice, first in real time and then again as an echo. The echo died, and Reacher heard a solenoid open and a bolt shoot home, a loud, precise sound like a single shot from a distant rifle. The four figures kept on coming. Reacher kept on walking. They met in the center of the hidden space. Thurman and his men stopped. They stood still, 5 feet short of an imaginary line that ran between the pile of wrecked tanks and the 18-wheeler. Reacher stopped 5 feet on the other side. Vaughn kept on going. She picked her way through the mud and made it to Reacher's side and turned around, put a hand on his arm. 2 against 3. Thurman called,
"What are you doing here?"
Reacher could hear the rain beating against the slickers. 3 guys, 3 sets of shoulders, 3 hats, stiff plastic material. He said,
"I'm looking around."
"At what?"
"At what you've got here."
Thurman said,
"I'm losing patience."
"What's in the truck?"
"What kind of incredible arrogance makes you think you're entitled to an answer to that question?"
"No kind of arrogance," Reacher said. "Just the law of the jungle. You answer, I leave. You don't, I don't."
Thurman said,
"My tolerance for you is nearly exhausted."
"What's in the truck?"
Thurman breathed in, breathed out. glanced to his right at his foreman, and then beyond the foreman at the giant with the wrench. He looked at Vaughn, and then back at Reacher. Reacher said, "What's in the truck?" Thurman said,
"There are gifts in the truck."
"What kind?"
"Clothes, blankets, medical supplies, eyeglasses, prosthetic limbs, dried and powdered foodstuffs, purified water, antibiotics, vitamins, sheets of construction-grade plywood, things like that."
"Where from?"
"They were bought with tithes from the people of despair."
"Why?"
"Because Jesus said it is more blessed to give than to receive."
"Who are the gifts for?"
"Afghanistan. For refugees and displaced persons and those living in poverty."
"Why is the container welded shut?"
"Because it has a long and perilous journey ahead of it, through many countries and many tribal areas where warlords routinely steal, and padlocks on shipping containers can be broken, as you well know."
"Why put it all together here, in secret?"
"Because Jesus said, when you give alms, do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing, so that your alms may be in secret. We follow Scripture here, Mr. Reacher, as should you."
"Why turn out the whole town in defense of a truck full of gifts?"
"Because we believe that charity should know neither race nor creed. We give to Muslims, and not everyone in America is happy with that policy. Some feel that we should give only to fellow Christians. An element of militancy has entered the debate, although in fact it was the Prophet Muhammad himself who said a man's first charity should be to his own family, not Jesus. Jesus said, 'Whatever you wish that men would do to you, do so to them.' He said, 'Love your enemies, and pray for those who persecute you, so that you may be sons of your Father who is in heaven.'"
"Where are the cars from Iran?"
"The what?"
"The cars from Iran."
"Melted down and shipped out."
"Where is the TNT?
"The what?"
"You bought 20 tons of TNT from Kearney Chemical 3 months ago." Thurman smiled.
"Oh, that. It was a mistake. A typo, a coding error. A new girl in the office was one number off on Kearney's order form. We got TNT instead of TCE. They're adjacent in Kearney's inventory. If you were a chemist, you'd understand why. We sent it back immediately on the same truck. Didn't even unload. If you had troubled yourself to break into invoicing as well as purchasing, you would have seen our application for a credit."
"Where is the uranium?"
"The what?"
"You pulled 20 tons of depleted uranium out of these tanks, and I just walked all over this compound and I didn't see it."
"You're standing on it."
Vaughn looked down. Reacher looked down. Thurman said,
"It's buried. I take security extremely seriously. It could be stolen and used in a dirty bomb. The state is reluctant to let the army move it, so I keep it in the ground."
"I don't see signs of digging."
"It's the rain. Everything is churned up."
Reacher said nothing. Thurman said,
"Satisfied?"
Reacher said nothing. He glanced right at the 18-wheeler, left at the parked backhoe, down at the ground. The rain splashed in puddles all around and thrashed against the slickers 10 feet away.
"Satisfied?"
Thurman asked again. Reacher said, "I might be, after I've made a phone call."
What phone call?
I think you know.
I don't, actually.
Reacher said nothing.